Welcome to the Negotiations Ninja podcast, where we develop and deliver the most engaging negotiation content and training in the world. We host negotiation experts, business people, and entrepreneurs, and discuss what works, what doesn't work, and how we can improve our negotiation skills. Listeners, welcome to the Negotiations Ninja podcast and this amazing throwback edition to a conversation that I had with Roger Dooley on the science of influence for negotiation. And we talk all about prompting buying decisions. So how do we use influence to prompt buying decisions with the people that we are negotiating with? It was an absolutely fascinating conversation. I think you're going to love this throwback episode with Roger Dooley. Hi, Roger. How are you?
I'm doing great, Mark. Happy to be here.
Yeah, thanks so much for being on the show, man. I really appreciate it.
Well, it's my pleasure. Always interesting to talk to folks who are interested in persuasion and negotiation.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun. For the listeners who don't know about you and the books that you've written, could you give us a brief background as to sort of who you are, what you do, and the books you've written, including Friction, which is your newest book?
Sure. And I'll keep this fairly compressed. I started off by becoming educated as an engineer, which I only did for a few years, earned my MBA a little bit after that. And after a bit transitioned to more corporate strategy, then just as my corporate career seemed to be taking off, I was leading corporate strategy for a Fortune 1000 company when I was about 29. I chose that moment to bail out and become an entrepreneur, and I've pretty much been an entrepreneur ever since. Started initially a direct marketing company aimed at the earliest owners of home computers, and that transitioned into multiple different businesses in the IT space and eventually the digital marketing space. And along the way, I built a business called College Confidential, which became the busiest website for college-bound students and parents in the U.S. and perhaps in the world. Sold that to part of the Daily Mail Group. And while that was in process, I began what was sort of a hobby site almost. I saw the two areas were coming together about 15 years ago. Those areas were neuroscience and marketing. And I'd always had an interest in the intersection of marketing and psychology and advertising and so on. And this was kind of intriguing. So I registered a domain. I started writing there. And over time, I kept writing. People were reading and sort of guiding me a little bit away from the sort of hard neuroscience aspects into more psychology and behavioral science. And that ultimately led to my first book, Brainfluence, about 7-8 years ago now. And my more recent book is called Friction, and it explores the cause and effect of human effort and how that changes our behavior as humans. And not to give away the punchline, but even a little bit of effort changes human behavior quite powerfully. And as a result, we can use that to say, change customer behavior, to get customers to order, or even steer customers in a particular direction.
Fantastic. And that's why I'm so excited to have you on the show, because human behavior is something that we talk about quite a lot on the show, specifically when it comes to negotiation, persuasion, influence, all of that kind of stuff. And in your first book, in Brainfluence, which is brilliant, by the way, you said that most of us are willing to spend more money if we think we're getting a deal, which sort of, I mean, just perception overall there, I think is a really big deal for us to talk about. What do you mean by this? Can you expand on this?
Well, I think there's a lot of ways of looking at that, Mark. First of all, if we go all the way back to our hunter-gatherer days, and there are quite a few psychologists who think that many of our current human behaviors can be traced back to those hunter-gatherer days, even though now we're living in this world of devices in our pockets and social media and everything else. We're still following those same programs that were laid down tens of thousands of years ago. And one concept is sort of the low-hanging fruit concept. When something is more accessible to us, we are more likely to grab it. And there's some interesting studies that show when they measure people's brainwave activity in a simulated supermarket situation or in a real supermarket where people can walk around just wearing a simple little cap and look at stuff and put stuff in their shopping cart. One thing they found was that those yellow sale tags that you see on items like, this week only, this is 99 cents instead of $1.50 or something of that nature. People responded to those. Their brains lit up when they saw those sale prices. And even more interesting, a yellow tag that wasn't actually a sale had almost the same effect. So people are looking for bargains. When you can communicate that something is a bargain price, then that will probably be a more effective sale. And there's lots of ways of doing that. You can use what's called anchoring, which is to set people's expectations with a higher price and then show them that the actual offer is going to be less than that. We see that in infomercials on television where they'll tell you that thousands were sold at $199 they'll say this bundle, if you add up the values of everything that's in this bundle, it's worth $299. And these are setting anchors for you saying, okay, well, this deal might be worth $199 or $299, but really then they're going to give you an offer. But today only, if you order in the next 30 minutes, you can have all this for just $99. Or maybe even then say, or three payments of $33. And so they've set this price anchor that's very high. And by the time you see what you're actually going to pay, it just seems much lower.
Yeah, fascinating. And then they'll throw in the additional value on the end, get a foldable cutting board and a meat smoker.
I think infomercials can be instructive to all marketers and other business people, because if you see an infomercial that's been running for a while, you saw it this week and then you saw it a few weeks ago and maybe a month before that, not that you should be watching infomercials all the time, but if you see it and it's the pitch is fairly consistent, that is working, because these companies that produce the infomercials do extensive testing, and the only way they can afford to air those things is if they are making money. So if you see a technique there that's been used for a while, it works. And I think you can extend that to something that probably more of us experience on a near daily basis, and that is Amazon.com, where Amazon is constantly running hundreds of A-B tests on everything from pricing to different website features, different wording, and so on. And if you pay close attention, sometimes you can see some of these tests in action. But again, if you see something that's been on the Amazon site for a while, it's there because it works and it helped them sell more stuff.
Yeah. You bring up an interesting point. I think a lot of people get stuck in a rut when it comes to negotiation or sales, and they deliver the same line over and over again without doing any sort of A-B testing to see what may work better. And one thing that I think people need to be aware of, especially when they look at like marketing and advertising, is there is, like you say, things to be learned there about how we can use different words, different techniques, different sentence structures, maybe even different tonality or body language to see if we can elicit a different response from whomever we're negotiating with to see if it works better.
Right. Well, I think you've said a couple of things there, Mark. First of all, jumping back to the beginning of the podcast where you said that you frequently focus on human behavior. I think that one thing that people, particularly in a B2B setting, often neglect is that their customers are humans. They are not optimizing robots the way some people think that, this is, I've had so many people tell me, well, the stuff that you talk about, that's good for consumers, but I deal with business customers and, they make their decisions based on price and delivery and service and so on. And certainly those things are important, but they are not the only things, because those buyers are humans. And I suspect the people who listen to your podcast pretty frequently, Mark, already have reached that point of understanding. So the second point that you brought up more just now was A-B testing. And that's something that often in negotiating situations is hard to do because it's a small sample size. You know, if you can test something on the web or in by mailing a few thousand direct mail pieces, that can give you a statistically valid response. But in negotiation, I think you have to accept the fact that a small sample size, if you're doing one-on-one negotiation, is inevitable. So there you want to try and apply rules that seem to have worked in other situations and at least run a few tests of your own. Try something different. And if it works, recognize that that may not be the magic formula at that point. It could be that you just got lucky or that particular buyer was susceptible to that technique. But nevertheless, you know, it's worth trying. And over time, you can accumulate enough information to feel some degree of confidence that what you're doing is the best approach.
Yeah, brilliant. Exactly. I think we seem to have a bias towards what we've used in the past, and that sort of makes sense. And that stops us from using new techniques. And the more and more we can sample and try a new techniques, we'll see more and more what works and what doesn't work. And you spoke about stats. Speaking of stats, you mentioned in the book that our brains have a preference for trusted stories as opposed to detailed statistics whenever we're being sold something or whenever we're getting a referral from someone or a reference from someone, which sort of flies in the face of like a lot of people that think that they're super logical and they trust stats and all that kind of stuff. Why is it that you believe our brains trust stories more than stats? This one is for my procurement listeners. Listen up. I want to invite you to ProcureCon Indirect West this September 16th through 18th at the beautiful JW Marriott Camelback Inn Resort and Spa in Scottsdale, Arizona. Procurement listeners can save 25% off the current price with Negotiations Ninja special code PIW19N. N. I'm going to repeat that. That's PIW19NN. ProcureCon Indirect West provides you with the critical strategies that you need to prepare for the future of procurement. With an agenda 100% focused on your biggest challenges and opportunities, you'll attend more than 40 interactive sessions led by 80 plus inspiring speakers who are transforming the procurement function at some of the world's largest companies, all while meeting over 300 of your peers who are excited to benchmark, talk shop, and have some fun. Whether you're a rising star or a CPO, a large or a small company spend, ProcureCon has content and speakers to ensure your long-term sourcing success. Go to ProcureConWest.com to learn more and register with that code PIW19NN to get 25% off your ticket. I'll see you there. And now, back to your show.
Well, an evolutionary psychologist would say that our brains are programmed to listen to stories, to pay attention to stories, because in those early days when you had a community of humans perhaps gathered around a campfire, somebody would come back from a day of hunting or exploring and have important information to communicate. Hey, I found a new food source. Hey, I found a cave, but there's a bear that lives in it, which could be things that are really important for everybody else to know. And that was a great advantage for humans that they could communicate this so that each person would not have to go experience that for themselves. One person could, and they could come back and explain it to everybody. So assuming that was an evolutionary advantage, it would make sense that our brains evolved to pay attention to stories. But I think whether you buy that explanation or not, there is so much evidence that's very practical, that when people hear a story, they start paying attention. And one interesting scientific indication of that is that when you put people in an fMRI machine, and that measures their brain activity almost in real time, it gives a 3D image of the brain, seeing which areas are lighting up. When you read them a story that has action words in it, the motor areas in their brain are mimicking those actions, even though they're immobilized in this tube, they can't move a muscle while they're in the fMRI machine. The motor areas might be thinking about running or hammering or whatever the words are that are being described. So stories have that effect in our brain. And an even more interesting fMRI experiment put two people in two separate fMRI machines. So each one's brain activity was being monitored, and they had the first person tell the second person a story. And what they found, even blew the mind of the scientists doing it, they found that after just a few seconds of the story, the second person's brain activity synchronized with the brain activity of the first one. So if you want to exercise mind control over somebody, telling them a story is about the best way to do that.
Have you read Dan Pink's book, To Sell Is Human?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, brilliant. So, and just for the listeners,
Dan's great. His all of his books are great.
Yeah. For the listeners, just so that you know, I recommend that you pick up this book, because Dan actually goes through like a standard story format that Pixar now uses for all of its stories. And it's this really standard format. And if you can apply that format to your stories, what you'll find is that your story becomes more convincing. One of the things that we want to try and make more convincing are the prices that we show of maybe the service or the product that we sell. And sometimes whenever we sell something, when we say the price, the buyer might get a sticker shock, right? They get that ouch response to whatever it is that we're trying to sell. How do we produce less of a sticker shock response to the pricing of our product or service?
Right. Well, there are myriad ways of doing that. We already talked about anchoring. You might expect this to cost X, but it really only costs Y. You can use bundling. If you have, say, several products that might separately seem expensive, by putting them in a bundle, it makes it much harder for the buyer to differentiate. So a classic example of that is when you are interested in leather upholstery for your car and versus the standard cloth upholstery. Often, rather than simply saying, okay, it's going to cost you $2,000 for the leather upholstery, where if you compare that to the price of a nice leather chair in the furniture store, you might say, well, gee, that seems pretty high just to change out that material. But when it's part of the luxury package that includes an upgraded sound system and perhaps some other interior, exterior features, then it's pretty hard to tell, okay, well, how much does this cost? How much does that cost? And the overall $3,000 may seem, well, okay, it's a lot of money, but I want all this stuff. So, I mean, that's one way. And I think it's important to try and do that in a fashion that's not deceptive or misleading to the consumer, but that's yet another way of doing it. And you can use different price products to position things. Sometimes some people call this decoy marketing, and there are various kinds. One simple way is to have... if you have, say, two products in your product line, an inexpensive one and a more expensive one, if you want to sell more of the more expensive one, because often people gravitate to the cheaper one, then if you introduce a third product that's even higher priced and has more features, even if people do not buy that product, even if they say, wow, that's really expensive, it will position your previously high-priced product not as the high-priced one, but rather as the middle-of-the-road choice, a sort of logical choice, not the cheapest, not the most costly. So, that's been tested. An appliance company, a mail-order company was selling appliances, tested that, where they had two bread makers, I think they were, and then they introduced this really expensive bread maker, and they did not sell any of those, or they sold very few of the expensive bread maker, but suddenly sales of what was now the middle priced one skyrocketed.
Brilliant, because of that sort of good, better, best strategy.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Fascinating. And so basically what you're doing is you're building in a placed decoy to drive eyes towards something that you actually want to sell.
Right. And a different kind of decoy marketing was discovered by experiments by Dan Ariely, who's also written some great books like Predictably Irrational. In those tests, what he did was he introduced a second product that was almost as good as was not as good as the product that he wanted to sell, but was priced either at the same price or almost as much. And what happened is kind of strange. This product that nobody would buy because, well, the other one was clearly superior for either the same price or just almost no money more, it caused sales of the higher priced product to increase dramatically. And what they speculate was going on in people's heads, not consciously but unconsciously, is that they compare the two items. Since they're very similar and similarly priced, they compare the two, and one turns out, well, that one's much better for that same price or almost the same price, and that makes it overall more attractive. So that's yet another thing you can do. It may not work in every situation, but recommended. And Dan even gives an example of from sort of everyday behavior. He says that if you were going to, say, a party or going out to a club, and you would like to meet attractive people of your persuasion, then what you should do is take a wingman with you who is slightly less attractive. And,
brilliant.
When you talk to somebody, they will make that comparison, and you will look better than you would have had you simply gone alone. Although he cautions you that if somebody says, hey, you want to go out to the club tonight, perhaps you are the less attractive wingman.
Decoy marketing in the club scene. That's hilarious. Very, very cool. Hey, salespeople, I hope you're taking note of this. This is gold material. One of the things that you talk about as well in your book is how to build trust. One of the things that we talk about a lot on the show is how can we build trust with our customers, with the people that we're negotiating with, because people tend to do more business with you if they trust you. So how do we build trust with our customers?
Well, I think the first thing is not necessarily a brain hack. It's sort of simple logic, and that is behave in a trustworthy fashion. I trust Amazon probably more than any other brand, and it's not because they have used some sophisticated persuasion technique to make me trust more. It's because they are always accurate when they say, if they say it's going to be there in 48 hours, 99%+ of the time it's there in 48 hours. If there's something wrong with the product, they always honor their guarantee. I don't find that there's some kind of catch. If you've ever had a product go bad and you find out that, hey, I've got a 2-year warranty on this. Well, yeah, that 2-year warranty only covers parts, and you've got to pay to ship it back to us, and we're going to pay for us to ship it back to you. And by the end of it, you say, well, that's going to cost me as much as buying a new one. That is not the sort of behavior that builds trust. So one is just always behave in a fashion that is trustworthy. Pretty simple stuff, but a lot of companies don't do that. But there are some other things. Perhaps one really key way to build trust is reciprocation. There's research showing that people trust you if you show trust in them first.
Cialdini talks about that, right?
Yeah, and Amazon does that too. When you return an item, if you drop it off in one of their lockers or at UPS where they scan it in, by the time you get home, you may have an email from them saying, hey, we see that you've dropped off that return item. We have credited your account. Now, they don't know that you returned the item you said you were going to return. It might be an empty box. Could be another item. It could be badly damaged where you said it was fine. Whatever. They trust you enough to do that. In turn, you trust them. And there's another good example of this. One thing that con artists will do in order to gain your trust, because that's how they make their money and deceive you into somehow obliging them with their scam, is they show they trust you by, say, picking up a wallet saying, hey, I just found this. There's a bunch of money in it. I'm going to go see if I can find the person who dropped it. Will you hold it for a minute? Now, they are apparently trusting you because you're holding this wallet with money in it. So, you know, clearly if they were bad people, they wouldn't trust you. They would simply run off with the wallet, right? But they trust you. And then in turn, that sets you up for the final scam where you end up somehow giving them a bunch of more money. And, you know, it's I don't advocate that people become con artists, but the more you can show that you trust people, the more they will trust you.
Brilliant. Brilliant. I love it. Listen, I'd love for you to talk about friction in a little bit more depth as well. I know it's your new book, and I want to give you time to do that. So what? Tell us about friction, because I was so taken by Brainfluence that I'm sure friction is going to be fantastic.
Right. Well, Friction is a pretty wide-ranging book that I think people will enjoy simply because of the diversity of ideas in there. But the basic premise comes from behavioral science, and that is the law of least effort, which probably goes back to William of Ockham, who didn't express it quite in those words, but much more recently, our Nobel Prize winner, Daniel Kahneman, said that there's a law of least effort that applies to both cognitive and physical exertion. And then he followed that up by saying that people are basically lazy.
And yeah, system one and system two thinking, basically,
yes,
right?
Yes, and that's, you know, jumping, since you mentioned system one, system two, jumping back to your comment about statistics, if you are trying to persuade with facts and figures and statistics and logical arguments, you are trying to appeal to your customer or your negotiation partner's system two thinking, which is uncomfortable for them. It's high effort for them. They don't want to do that, they will try and get out of that mode of thinking as quickly as they can because it's much easier to think in system one, which is more emotional and rule-based, simple, it's low effort, low energy expenditure. So that's another reason to use simpler, more emotional arguments, stories, and so on. But anyway, jumping back to friction, if you except that there is this law of least effort that exists, it turns out that it affects just about all aspects of human behavior. It affects customer experience dramatically. And I often refer to Amazon, as you may have noticed, but one thing that they do brilliantly is make it easier to place an order than anybody else. When you go to Amazon.com, you are always logged in. They never log you out. They never say, hey, we don't recognize you. We've got three questions to ask you, or we're going to send a message to your phone with a number in it. You're always logged in, ready to order. If you're a Prime member, which just about everybody is these days, it seems, you are all set there for one-click ordering with free delivery within 48 hours. And that one-click button is always available to you. They don't have no security. If you do, if you engage in high risk behavior, a higher risk for them perhaps of say sending gift certificates to people by email, which are basically cash, or if you want to ship something to an address you've never shipped to before, they will re-authenticate you under those conditions. But most of the time, 99% of the things you want to do, you can do with almost no effort on their site, and no other e-commerce site delivers an experience that is that frictionless. And that's one reason why they own half of all e-commerce now, and they just make things super easy. Even one more example from them, probably about a dozen years ago now, they noticed that people were struggling with these plastic clamshell packages. You know, like you buy a little piece of electronic gear or something, and it comes in this plastic thing that you can't tear open with your hands. You know, you've got to use scissors or a knife or a chainsaw or something to get into it. it's frustrating. It's dangerous. You're worried that you're going to damage the product or worse, even stab yourself with a sharp plastic shard. They decided that they didn't need that packaging, particularly considering their sales model. They don't have these things on display. So they developed frustration-free packaging, these simple little cardboard boxes that are way better for the environment. They're easy for customers to open without tools. There's minimal risk of injury, and people liked it. And the fascinating thing, Mark, was that not only did people like the packaging, the products themselves were better liked. There was a 73% reduction in negative comments about products that were packaged that way. So this minimization of effort elimination of friction had a positive effect in multiple ways. So, you know, and all throughout the customer experience, you probably have had a lot of experiences where you're trying to get information about a product or perhaps buy something, and you're struggling with it. You've got to create an account to make the purchase. They've got some crazy password requirement that you can't seem to figure out. Companies make it so difficult to do business with them, where it's just so simple to make it easy. That's why I wrote a book about friction, was because, if you have a website and you're trying to get people to do stuff, maybe turn into leads, maybe turn into customers, there's a lot of things that you can do to increase their motivation. You can offer bigger discounts, you can offer premiums, you can offer freebies, but most of these things cost money, where often if you just made it easier, you could get an equivalent boost in your conversion rate. And then as I was really focused on that, I found that once people start focusing on that for their customers, they realize that their own processes in their company, what their employees are having to do, also can contain a lot of friction. There are bad processes that consume extra time, that people waste their time on. Perhaps they're creating reports that nobody is looking at. They are spending time in meetings that really aren't necessary for them to do their job or to serve the customer. And all these things are wasting their time. And this has really a negative effect. First of all, it's wasted productivity. They could be doing productive stuff instead of this other stuff. But more importantly, it affects their engagement with the company. We've got an engagement crisis right now, where according to Gallup, 85% of employees are not actively engaged with their employer, which means that they're putting in their time, but they aren't really motivated, say, to go that extra mile to take care of a customer or to do something for the company. And one way to boost that is to show that you are trying to make the employee's job easier by eliminating the stuff that is unproductive for them, not necessary for the company. When people see that you care, when employees see that you care about not getting more out of them, not making them work harder, but making their job easier, that really changes the dynamic, and it's going to increase engagement and increase loyalty.
Wow, fascinating, fascinating, fascinating. Can you share with the listeners where they can follow you online?
The best place to start would be rogerdooley.com. And there I've got jumping off points to my various blogs, my own podcast, BrainFluence, to my books, and so on. On social media, I am most commonly found on Twitter at the handle @RogerDooley. Same thing on Instagram. And you can also find me on LinkedIn.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much for investing time with us today. Really appreciate it, Roger. I thought BrainFluence was fantastic. Really, really, really interesting book. And I think directly applicable to how we do our business on this show. We've got salespeople, we've got procurement people, we've got crisis negotiators. All of us are trying to influence and persuade others to do what we need them to do to get to a specific goal. And your book definitely helps us with that. So thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Mark. And considering the specifics of your audience, I think that Friction 2 can be a path where, instead of, say, making a financial concession, somehow making things easier for the other party might yield just as good a result. So anyway, I really appreciate the opportunity to be on the show, Mark. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Hey friends, thanks so much for listening to this episode. If you enjoyed it, please share it with friends and colleagues so that they can benefit from it as well. If you find Negotiations Ninja Podcast worthy, please go onto iTunes and give us a cool rating with a nice review. We certainly appreciate every single one that we get, because it helps us to understand who is listening, how they're listening, and what it is they like. If there's something that you would like me to discuss around negotiation, influence, or persuasion, give me a shout. You know how to reach me on social media, or you can get me on my website, which is www.negotiations.ninja.